like we said, my name is Devin. I come from Leduc. I was most previously serving in a church in Edmonton. I was youth pastoring there and resigned from there about a year ago. Actually, not about a year. It was a year to the week of this week that I was last with them in Edmonton. And me and my wife have been just pursuing and looking for our next ministry opportunity and position and just working. In the meantime, it's funny how when you're not doing your dream job, they still expect you to pay your mortgage. And so I keep working. I just have to do it. I'm a girl dad, as they say. I have two daughters. I have two little girls. Georgia, who's 3 years old, and baby Ruth, who is 5 months old. And so they're actually at home watching right now, I hope. Hi, girls. Be good to your mom. They are giving me a run for my money. So I grew up in a home full of boys. I'm one of three boys. And our house was exactly what you'd expect from a house full of boys. There was a lot of competition and physical altercation. And I didn't know that you could only have girls. I didn't know that that was an option. my friends were all guys, you know, and I had brothers. And now I'm in this totally different world. So if there are any fathers of daughters out there, please pray for me. Please pray for me. I just want to talk about last night for a second. You've heard a lot about it, and I just want to say it is amazing to be a part of that. Like, my heart and passion and desire is for the next generation, and I don't think there's any place in the world I'd rather be than a room full of teenagers worshiping Jesus. And so I was honored to be a part of that. Thank you again, Chris, for the invitation. Do you know that the vast majority of people in churches across Canada right now made a decision to follow Jesus before they turned 18? Most people. That's not everybody's story, for sure. But for a lot of people, it is. And we have this incredible opportunity with events like that to reach people and to introduce them to church and to faith and to Christian community. And so it's super important. I believe that investing in the next generation isn't optional. It's essential. We have to do it. It has to be a priority because they're not the church of tomorrow. They're the church of today, and they're just so special. There's no room that has more potential in it than a room full of teenagers pursuing Jesus. And so it's special. It's great. And now I want to honor two more people that of all the people, volunteers. You're amazing, Pastor Chris, and the other youth pastors involved in making it happen. We're amazing, but. But I don't know if you realized that Pastor Dwayne and Judy were here serving all day. Do you know that they gave up a Saturday when, I don't know what your week usually looks like, but I assume you could have been doing other things. And they were here, not the center of attention. They were in the kitchen. They were vacuuming. They were setting up chairs. They were cleaning. And so I just want to honor, and maybe you would join me in honoring your pastors for that. I heard somebody say that the ceiling for youth ministry in a church is the leadership, is the lead pastors. When I see lead pastors coming to serve for no recognition of their own, not to be in front of the crowd, but just to serve, to make it a great event for teenagers, there's a high, high ceiling for the youth ministry of this church. So thank you. Thank you guys for doing that. So I have a question for you. I have a question for you this morning. Have you ever been in a place, in a situation in your life where you feel like you're the only one or you're part of a very small majority of people trying to follow Jesus? When you think about your workplace, your family, your day-to-day life, does it ever feel like maybe you're the only one or maybe you're a part of a very small few doing your best to follow Jesus? Maybe you work in an environment where the conversation gets crude at times, makes you feel a little uncomfortable and uneasy, like you're on the outside looking in. Maybe you go to school, you're a student or even a teacher, and you're around people that are consumed with a worldview that is in complete opposition to your own. And it feels like, I feel like I'm the only one here trying to follow Jesus. Maybe it's even in your own family. Maybe this is a bright spot of your week because you get to come and be with other followers of Jesus, but when you go home, you're the only one. And it's really tough. I know in my season of life right now, Like I said, I've been in church ministry doing stuff like this for over a decade, but I find myself in this season where I'm not working in a church. I'm working in construction, in the trades. And it's great. I have nothing bad to say about it. I'm grateful for a job. I'm grateful for the work. I work with good people, but there's no question that there are times I come profoundly aware that I think I'm the only one trying to follow Jesus here. I'm pretty sure. Sometimes the music and the conversation and the jokes and the lifestyle choices, they wouldn't reflect someone who has much regard for the Bible or for a Jesus-centered way of life. And I come profoundly aware that I think I'm the only one. I think I'm the only one trying to live differently here. Now, this isn't about me, and I certainly am not the only one who experiences or feels that, right? That's probably the reality of most people in the room with us this morning and churches across our nation. That's probably the reality in some way or another in your life too. Because the truth is, Canada has gone so far from what we would consider a generally Christian value-based system. We've moved so far away from that, and we have been so far away for so long that the quote-unquote experts say we're actually closer to a pre-Christian culture than a post-Christian culture. And so what I mean by that is there are so many people, when you think about younger millennial generation, Gen Z and Gen Alpha, who have had no experience with the Bible, Jesus, church, faith, that it's not even that they know the things and have rejected it and moved away, it's that they've never even been introduced to it in the first place. And so we've moved so far past post-Christian that we know the things and we've been to church and that's what we do culturally, that we're actually closer to pre-Christian. Like we haven't even had the move of God yet. They haven't even experienced the love of Jesus yet. It's not that they know and have rejected it. It's that they've never been introduced to it. Which leaves us in a pretty tricky spot, doesn't it? As those who are out there every day trying to follow Jesus the best that we can, wondering how do we navigate the complexities of life and faith in our culture? How do we live this out in a healthy way in the midst of a world who has, generally speaking, a totally different perspective? Wondering how do we raise our kids? How do we raise our kids to know and love and follow Jesus when so much of the world around them is telling them otherwise? How do we operate with integrity and honesty in our workplaces when it seems like everywhere we look, people are willing to cut corners and take the easy way and would be willing to do whatever they could to elevate their own standing? And we're left wondering, is it even worth it? Like, I'm the only one. Do I even try to keep this going? Ultimately, how do we resist compromise and stand firm on what we believe when it'd be so much easier to just follow the crowd? Like, it'd be so much easier to just float down the current of culture than to try to swim upstream. The question is, how do we live faithfully in a faithless culture? How do we live faithfully in a faithless culture? And you know, that's a question we have to ask ourselves and wrestle with today in 2025. But the good news is that we're not the only ones who have ever had to do this. And I think of the story of Daniel, the man of the Old Testament, who had to ask the same question for himself in ancient Babylon. And so today, this morning, we're going to turn to the book of Daniel, and we're going to look at his life, and we're going to read some things. So if you have a Bible, you can go ahead and turn to Daniel. We're going to start in Daniel chapter 1. And now Daniel is a big book. And it is deep, and it is complex, and there is so much in it, and we certainly are not going to try and cover the whole thing in one morning, okay? You could preach for weeks and months about this. We're just going to take a few minutes today. We're going to highlight some main plot points along the way, along the journey of Daniel's life, and observe what can we learn from the way Daniel lived in ancient Babylon, and how does that translate to us in Canada in 2025? Daniel knew all too well what it felt like to be the only one, or at best a part of a select few trying to do their best to live faithfully in a faithless culture. So, Daniel chapter 1, we're going to start in verse 3, and we're going to read all the way to chapter 20. If you don't have a Bible with you, you can follow along with the Bible in the sky. I think it'll be up there. We're going to do some Bible reading, okay? So get your reading glasses out, get in a comfy position in your chair, settle in. First thing I want to look at is this idea that Daniel knew where to draw the line from the very beginning. He knew where in his life he had to draw the line that he would not cross. Okay, so let's read Daniel chapter 1, verses 3, all the way to chapter verse 20. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Okay, let me stop here and just let you know. Daniel was living in Jerusalem, Israel, and they had been taken captive by King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. And not only did they overthrow them, but they took them into captivity and brought them back to Babylon with them. Okay, so this is where we find Daniel in the story. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Try to say that 10 times fast. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servant for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance with the other young men who had eaten the royal food, and treat your servants with accordance in what you see." So he agreed to this, and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. It's amazing. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into the king's service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, they found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. Wow. Okay, it's a lot to read. So Daniel and his 3 friends find themselves in a pretty tricky situation. They had been taken captive. They had been removed from their culture, from their homes, from their everyday life and rhythms, their faith communities, and they're taken to Babylon, and they go into a 3-year training program, which at the end would lead them into service of a foreign king. And this is where we find them. And the verse I want to highlight to you, in the midst of their entire world being turned upside down, everything be assimilated into a new culture, even down to their names, that they would not even carry their own identity, that they'd be given a new name. Verse 8 says this: Daniel resolved not to defile himself by consuming the royal food and wine. The Bible tells us that Daniel had made up his mind from the beginning that this was not a line he was willing to cross. And all the things that were happening, he would not go over that line. See, the royal food and wine, like, we have to ask ourselves why. What was so big about this? Well, the royal food and wine, the king, the food of the king's table, it wasn't like the king was sitting at a giant table and these guys got to come in and grab a plate, buffet style, and just kind of take some of the king's food and then go back and eat it. It was this food that was set aside by the king for anyone who worked in the king's service, okay? But the thing that Daniel knew about this food is that it was offered to pagan gods and idols in an act of worship. It was a part of cultic pagan worship rituals. And Daniel, knowing this, said, "That is not a line I'm willing to cross. I will worship one God and one God only. I will not entertain the idea of worshiping anyone else. I will not participate in that idolatry. I won't do it. I won't do it." And it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of individuality, an act of choice in the midst of his entire world being assimilated to a different culture. It was a risky decision that could have turned out really bad. It could have turned out really bad. Don't forget, this isn't Daniel just hanging out with some friends, deciding not to eat something at a restaurant. Like, he is enslaved. He doesn't really have a choice on what he's doing. And he says, I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to defile myself in that way. And the three boys who join him, Daniel risked disgrace. He risked danger. He risked being kicked out of this training program and maybe even his own life. And it wasn't just him and the three boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? We read that Ashpenaz, the one who the king had put in charge of them, said, guys, you have to understand that I'm in charge of you, and if you end up worse off than the rest, the king's going to have my head. So Daniel was taking on a big risk, not with his own life, but with the life of the people around him. And you know, as we read, he said, okay, well, let's make a deal. Let's do a test, 10 days. We're not going to eat this for 10 days, and we'll see how we look at the end. And you be the judge, and then we'll deal with the consequences after that. It was a big risk, and he needed a miracle. I'm not going to get into the food science of it, but if you're eating like nothing or not much, you're probably not going to look healthier than someone who's eating a lot or like healthy, good food at the end of 10 days. And yet they do. And yet they do. And God shows his faithfulness, and there is a miracle in their midst. And at the end of 10 days, they said, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. But somehow you three are the healthiest among all the people here. I don't get it. I don't know how. So they took away the food. And they said, you do what you're going to do because clearly you knew something we don't. So Daniel and his friends, they continue to do this and they continue to grow in influence and they continue to rise through the ranks. One author and Bible scholar says this, Daniel and his friends were granted special wisdom by the Lord, not because of their diet, but because of their faith and their commitment to his word. Like, it's not about the food. Like, it's about the food, but it's not about the food. Right, the food isn't the main thing. It's that they were willing to draw a line in the sand and said, we will not cross this. We will not be a part of the worship of any other god. And at the end of 3 years, none were equal to Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These three boys, in fact, as they stood before the king, he said, you are 10 times better than all the others who had been in this training program. You're the best. Their risky decision wasn't about food. It was about faithfulness. And not compromising. They decided that although they had no choice in being where they were taken captive, they were exiles in a foreign land. They were willing to plant their flag. This was a hill they were willing to die on. Whatever the cost, whatever may come their way, we're not going to cross that line. Some of the things obviously were not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of life and faith and service to the Lord. But this was. It was as if Daniel was saying, I would rather die, I'd rather face the consequences in living faithfully than to cross the line of compromise and live in sin. So he says, you want me to learn the language? Fine. You want me to learn the culture and the customs? That's fine. You want me to learn the economy and the government? I'll do you one better. I'll do it better than anyone here. I'll be the best of the best. I will thrive, but I will not participate in the worship or the sacrifice to other gods. I just won't do it. And so Daniel remained faithful in the midst of an incredibly challenging and tricky situation. The next thing I want to look at, we're going to skip ahead all the way into chapter 6, is that the world around Daniel had changed multiple times. Not just like, hey, I moved houses. I went from Bonneville to St. Paul. Like Daniel's life and everything in it had changed, and yet his habits didn't. His habits remain the same. The world around Daniel changed, but his habits didn't. So we're going to skip way ahead in the story. And like I said, lots have happened in this time, but it's not our focus for right now. And now actually Babylon has been taken over. The one who had taken over Jerusalem and taken them captive, now Babylon has been taken over. And they're ruled by a man named Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede. So at this point in time, I'll catch you up in the story. Daniel has served faithfully King Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar's son or near relative, King Belshazzar. And now he's serving another foreign king who took over named Darius the Mede. And so Darius comes into charge of Babylon and all it had, and the Bible says that he appoints 120 satraps. So he appoints 120, basically government-appointed officials to rule over a region, right? It's a big place. One man can't oversee all of it, so he appoints 120 to oversee it, to kind of do his bidding in the land. But what's really interesting is that over those 120, the king appoints three administrators, three people that the 120 would be responsible to answer to. They would serve under their authority. And what is amazing is the Bible tells us that Daniel is one of those three. Daniel is rising through the ranks of power and authority and trust and influence in a foreign nation. He is one of the three appointed administrators in the land. Yet another conquering nation takes over and takes power. And Daniel finds himself as one of the most trusted and influential people in the entire nation. It's kind of amazing how sometimes we read the stories of the Bible and we're like, oh yeah, then this happened and this happened. And we know the end of the story. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you stop and think and you're like, Daniel, who was once an exiled teenager from Jerusalem, has now served three kings, and he is one of the four most important and powerful people in the entire nation. How did that happen? How did that happen? And it doesn't stop there, because he's one of the three, but the king says he's noticed Daniel's exceptional qualities, and he's about to put him over everything. So he said, even amongst the three highest ranking officials, there's something about you that is better. The exceptional qualities, the way you lead, that I'm actually going to put you over everything. He's about to become second in command to only the king. But as you can imagine, some of his peers start to get a little jealous. They don't really like that this exiled boy from a different nation is now showing them all up, and he's about to become their boss. And so they set up this scheme, and they're going to try everything they can to take him out. They don't like that he's found favor with the king. They don't like that the king likes him. And so they set up a trap. They set up a trap. And this is what we read in chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. At this point, the administrators and the satraps tried to find ground for charges against Daniel and his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against the man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his own God." They want to catch him. They want to trip him up. They want to get him in trouble, and they can't, because he's completely trustworthy. He's not corrupt. He's not taking bribes. He's not showing favoritism. He's not leading in that way. They can find no problem with him. They can't go to the king on any grounds and say, "Hey, look at Daniel. Look at how bad of a job he's doing. It's this big scandal. Did you know this?" They can't do it. They've tried and they can't find anything wrong with him. And they say, the only thing left we have is that we know he will be faithful to his God above all else. And so we have to use that against him. So the schemers come up with a plan. They go to the king and they start to butter him up. And they're like, "Oh, you're so great. You're so powerful. You know what you should do, king? We got a great idea. You should make a law that no one in the entire land can worship any other god except for God or man except for you for 30 days. Because you're so amazing. Wouldn't that be great?" And the king's like, "I am pretty great. This is a good idea. We should do it." And so they say, "Hey, don't just say it. Let's put it in writing. Make it an edict. Make it a declaration. Put it in writing." Because they knew that in the Persian culture and government, once a king puts something in writing, not even the king can take it back. And so he does it. And so for the next 30 days, the word goes out. Nobody can pray or worship any other person or God except for the king himself. And to make it worse, to deter people from doing it anyways, they say, "And if you are caught, you'll be thrown into a den of lions," which would mean absolute death. I don't know if you feel like you could survive a den of lions. I don't think I could. It would be absolute death. Because these people knew Daniel, and they knew the way he lived his life. They knew his practices and his rhythms, and they knew that if they could get the king to do this, it would cause Daniel to do one of two things. Daniel would either compromise and not worship and pray to his God, or he would remain faithful as he always has, and they could throw him in the den of lions. Either way, these jealous people win, and Daniel loses. And if you don't know yet, this is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Hopefully, this is connecting the dots. You're starting to remember. So we continue to read in Daniel chapter 6, verses 10 through 15. The Bible says this. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. And three times a day, he got down on his knees and he prayed, giving thanks to God, just as he had done before. The first thing he does when he hears about this horrible news, he says, too bad. He goes up to his room, he opens his windows toward Jerusalem, and he prays. And he doesn't say, God, save me, get me out of here. He gives thanks to his God. Verse 11 says, then these men went as a group, and they found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king, and they spoke to him about a royal decree, about his royal decree. King, did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human except you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? Don't you remember, king, that you did that? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, in case you forgot, who is one of the exiles of Jerusalem, he's not even one of us. Daniel pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing, and he still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel, and he made every effort until sundown to save him. In verse 15, then the men went as a group to King Darius and said, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. They caught him. The king had been tricked. It's interesting that they go to the king and they say, hey, didn't you make this law? Isn't this something, you know, we have to do? And he's like, you got to do it. Lion's den. And he's like, well, just so you know, Daniel's praying to his God. And it doesn't say the king is like, great, we get to punish somebody. The king is like, he's having a hard time. He's like, oh, this guy who I know and I trust, he's about to be ruler over all of this. Now I gotta throw him in the lion's den. He realized he's been tricked. He probably felt a little embarrassed. But he had to do it because the law is the law, and it's ironic that it's his law. It's his law. He can't change it. And so Daniel goes into the lion's den. They throw him in. But the story continues. Chapter 6, 19 to 23. And at first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. He'd been up all night waiting. I gotta go see Daniel. And when he came near the den, he called Daniel in an anguished voice. Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel responds, may the king live forever. Joyous words coming out of the den. My God sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. And nor have I done any wrong before you, your majesty. And the king was overjoyed. And he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And Daniel was lifted from the den, and no wound was found on him because he trusted God. What did... You guys are all sitting there like, this is everyday activity. That's incredible. He spent a night in a den, in a pit full of hungry lions. And an angel came and hung out with them and entertained the lions. And they left Daniel alone, and he survived. But you know something interesting about this that I learned as I studied? From the point of time that Daniel went into training for the king's service, those 3 years as a teenager, to the point of the lion's den, do you know how much time had elapsed? Scholars believe 60 to 70 years. I don't know why reading this story, because it's only 6 chapters in the Bible, I figured it wasn't that long. Like, he was probably pretty young. It had been 60 to 70 years of Daniel continually, faithfully serving a foreign king, and above all, serving his God. 60 to 70 years, that is a long time. Up to this point, the story tells us he served 3 kings faithfully. Daniel is living and serving faithfully. He's adding value to the culture. He's not just putting up with it. He's like thriving and excelling within it while maintaining his faithfulness to the Lord without compromise. I can't get over that verse that says Daniel went up to pray just as he has always done. He didn't change. The world around him changed. Everything had changed multiple times, but his habits didn't. He wasn't willing to let it change him. We don't know how those people knew where they would find Daniel. Like, the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us. But I got to think, if you're around someone for 60 to 70 years, you probably get to know their habits. And they knew where Daniel would be and what he'd be doing. So they issue the decree, they get the king to put it in writing, and the first chance they get, they say, let's go run up on Daniel, because we know he's going to be praying. Yeah. And they find him. There was something about the way he lived his life that the people around him knew what he was about. Yeah. We have to know that the courage to face a den full of hungry lions in chapter 6 started with being courageous and rejecting the royal food 60 to 70 years earlier in chapter 1. Years later, when everything in his world had changed again, yet again a part of a conquered nation serving a foreign king, Daniel didn't panic. He didn't try to make a new plan. He didn't try and escape. He just kept praying like he always had, like he always had. Regardless of the risk, regardless of what it might cost him, he just stayed true and stayed faithful. Everything in Daniel's world had changed, and yet Daniel remained anchored to spiritual practices that connected him to God. And so he continued to remain faithful in a faithless culture. And then the third thing I want us to look at, and last thing from Daniel's life, is that Daniel served with excellence and integrity. Well, you know, we just got a glimpse of it in that last story. They could find nothing wrong with him, nothing wrong about the way he lived and he governed. Daniel lived and served with excellence and integrity. While Daniel, despite being a Hebrew, conquered and oppressed multiple times over, is thrust into some of the highest ranking offices in the entire nation. That kind of blows my mind how that happens. Not once, but like multiple times over. See, Daniel didn't withdraw from Babylon. He served with excellence within it. He didn't try and escape. He didn't reject it. He just said, You think you have captured me? You think I'm going to become a part of your culture? I'm going to show you that there's actually a better way. I'm going to serve with excellence within it. We read in chapter 1, all the way back, we already read it, that as they went into training for the king's service, they came out the other end of 3 years, and they stood before the king, and the king said, there's something about you that is better than everyone else here. There's something about you. 10 times, 10x the rest of the people. And they grew in favor. In chapter 2, we didn't read this story, and I'll summarize it. Chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar has a wild dream. He has this crazy dream full of symbolism and all sorts of things. And he really wants to understand what it is. So he calls all his enchanters and his diviners and his magicians. And all these people are supposed to have this spiritual insight. And he says, come tell me my dream. And then tell me what it means. And if you don't, I'm going to kill all the wise men in the nation. Kind of a no-pressure situation. Somebody do it or else. And so he brings them, and if you know the story, none of them can do it. And they're like, King, this is insane. No king has ever asked this of anybody. This doesn't make any sense. Nobody can do it. And he says, then fine, if nobody can do it, you're all gonna die. And Daniel, who at this point is one of those wise men, hears this, that he's about to be killed. And he says, hold on a sec. Whoa, nobody came to consult with me first. And he goes to his friends and he says, listen, this is literally life or death. I need you to pray that God will show me the interpretation of this dream that we can save all of our lives. And sure enough, that night, God reveals to him the dream, the interpretation of it. And just so you know, it's not super positive for King Nebuchadnezzar. And so he goes to the king and he says, hey, listen, king. I don't have the power in myself to do this. Like, I'm not that guy. But God is the revealer of mysteries, and he has revealed this to me. And so here's your dream, and he spells it out in detail. And he says, this is what the Lord wants you to know. And he tells him the interpretation, and it's not great. Things are not looking good for King Nebuchadnezzar. And yet he does it faithfully anyways. He does it anyways. And this is what it said. Then the king said to Daniel, following this experience, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of all kings. He's the revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery to me. Then the king placed Daniel in a high position, lavished many gifts on him, and made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and in charge of all his wise men. Man, Daniel just kept living faithfully. He's not even looking for the promotion. He's not on this like 5-year, 10-year plan, trying to climb the corporate ladder. He was like, hold on a second, you're about to kill me because you don't know what your dream meant? I could do something about this. And God blesses him and gives him things and possessions and probably wealth and respect, and he puts him over the entire province. And then again in chapter 5, Daniel is serving King Belshazzar, another king, and he's at a party. And it's going crazy and something wild happens, and I'm going to read it for you from the text so you don't think I'm making up crazy stories. This is what the Bible says. Then the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster wall. In the midst of a party, we're just having a good old-fashioned Sunday potluck. And a hand appears. Doesn't say there's an arm attached or a body, just a hand. And it starts to write on the wall. And the king watched his hand as it wrote, and his face turned pale, and he was frightened, and his legs became weak, and his knees started knocking, as you would imagine. And so again, he calls all the spiritual people in the land and the magicians, and he says, somebody tell me what's going on, and none of them can. None of them understand. But the queen remembers stories she heard about a man named Daniel who served the previous king, who was seen to be smarter and had wisdom and understanding. And it was said about him that the spirit of the living gods was in him. And so they summon him, and Daniel comes, and he's like, listen, I don't want your gifts or notoriety. I'm not trying to go viral for this, okay? Don't video it. Don't put me on, you know, Instagram or anything. But I will tell you what God is saying. And so he interprets it, and he tells them. And again, not favorable for the king. But he tells them, and the king gives him royal robes, and he gives him a gold necklace. And he says that he put him in the third highest place in the entire kingdom. Again, Daniel, minding his own business, comes out of obscurity and is thrust into the highest offices of leadership and influence in a nation. It's amazing. And like we just read moments ago, Daniel serving another king, King Darius, continues to be faithful, rise through the ranks. He's a part of the three administrators, and he's over top of the three administrators. He's second only to the king. Daniel interpreted dreams and advised kings, and he led with integrity. He spoke truth respectfully, even when it might cost him something. He remained faithful to God in the activities that connected him to God. He was faithful, and his faithfulness led to favor, and his favor led to influence. Influence that covers, the Bible tells us, four named kings. Four kings we read about in the Bible. And if you overlap some history onto that, it's likely that Daniel served 5 to 7 foreign kings, spanning across 70-something years, faithfully. No fault found in him. Guys, Daniel didn't just serve Babylon. He outlasted Babylon. Did you know that? He didn't just serve within Babylon, a conquering nation. He outlasted it until it was conquered by another nation, and he thrived in the midst of it. Daniel didn't compromise his way of life. He didn't posture himself as Babylon's enemy either. He didn't just say, oh, this sucks, and kind of like, oh, well, guess I got to go along with it. He thrived. He was not an enemy of Babylon. He served with integrity to the point that pagan kings sought out his wisdom and guidance. Which is great for Daniel. But what about us? What does this have to do with us and our world? Because we might not face the threat of Babylon's kings. We might not face a lion's den. I hope that's not your life situation. But the truth is, we live in a culture that is very, for the most part, anti-Jesus, in opposition to the things of the Word of God, to the message of Jesus. And that creates real pressure that we feel. Though it might not be to the extremes that Daniel faces or maybe even other followers of Jesus around the world, but we can't deny that there is pressure on us from the world around us, and I don't want to minimize that. But we can be people who follow in Daniel's example. We can be people who know where the line in the sand is for our own life. You can know where the line in the sand is for your own life. Listen, don't wait for the pressure of culture and decisions that would cause you to conform and to compromise to be upon you before you know where the line is. Because if we wait until the pressures of the world are on us, compromise will feel so much easier. If we haven't taken the time with the Lord to think about it and think, like, what is happening in our world and what does your word say about it? How did Jesus respond in this situation? What, where is the line in the sand that I just won't cross regardless of what it costs me? We got to know where that is before it happens. The book of Romans, chapter 12, verse 2 reminds us not to conform to the world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. Another translation says it like this. Don't just fit into the world around you without thinking about what you're fitting into. Don't just go with the flow. We got to use some critical thinking. We got to know the word. We got to know what Jesus is asking of us. The second thing we can do is we can stay rooted in spiritual practices and rhythms. Okay? It's not by accident that Daniel served not a couple years, not 10 years, 20 years, but some 70 years faithfully in a foreign conquered nation. It's not by accident. That didn't just happen like, oh, look at where the time has gone. 70 years have gone by and here I am. Daniel made a point of being consistent in spiritual practices and rhythms that maintained his connection to God. And can I tell you the formula? It's not an infomercial. It's not a secret. Here's the formula. Ready? Pray regularly. Read the Bible consistently. And be active in Christian community. Can you do those things? Read the Bible regularly, pray consistently, be active in Christian community. Participate in this. If we want to be faithful like Daniel, we need to make these habits that we live by. And the third thing is this, live with integrity where God has placed you, right where you are right now. You can decide that I, whether anyone else does it or not, I'm going to live with integrity. I'm going to serve honestly. And faithfully. I don't know if Daniel loved being conquered and oppressed multiple times over. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. That would be horrible. I don't know if he liked being taken into a different culture and forced to change his entire ways, that even his name was changed. I don't think Daniel liked that. But one thing Daniel did was he was committed to not letting the external world, the things that were going on around him, change what was happening inside of him. Didn't change the way he lived his life. One author writes this, the call to follow Jesus is not a call to abandon culture. It's a call to live with excellence within it. It's not a call to say, I don't want any part of this world because Canada doesn't seem to reflect the message of Jesus. It's saying that I'm going to show the world that there's a better way. You're going this way, I'm going to show you true north. I'm going to show you that you can live with joy. I'm going to show you that there's a peace that goes beyond what our mind can understand. I'm going to show you that when the world is going crazy, I'm living at peace. Because I'm serving a king above all kings. But can I tell you one more thing? There's this quote I heard an author say one time. That says you'll never be invited to dine with a king if you stand outside the gate and throw stones. And can I be honest, that kind of hit me a little hard. Because it would be way easier to just bash, these leaders, these people, these decision makers, this nation, But you know what? We're never going to be invited to a place of influence as all we do is sit behind a keyboard or even face to face. And we just throw stones. You're so bad, I can't believe. We'll never be invited to dine with the kings, to have influence with leaders of nations, of people who make decisions and create culture. We'll never be invited into those places if all we do is throw stones at them. Now, I'm not saying we have to agree and just be like, well, this is what it is, so I guess it's our call. I'm not saying that at all. This is not my heart. And there are things in Canada that we should be like a little upset about. I don't like the way this is going, but I'm just saying that if all we do is throw stones, we won't be a part of the solution. They're never going to trust us. Somehow Daniel was able to serve four different kings in a foreign nation that their culture did not reflect the things of the Bible. And he served them faithfully, and he still served God faithfully. It can be done. The good news is we don't have to be afraid of the culture we live in. We don't have to be afraid. Whether it's ancient Babylon or it's modern day Canada, God gives us everything we need in the place we're at to live faithfully and make a difference. He's given us everything we need. You too can live faithfully. in sometimes what feels like a faithless culture. Here's the last thing I'm going to say today. You never know what God might do with your act of faithfulness. You never know who might be watching. You never know what it might do to somebody. Daniel didn't know what was on the other side of all the choices he made. We get to read and know the end of the story. Daniel didn't know it. He lived it. He didn't know what would happen when he rejected the royal food. He didn't know what would happen and how the kings would respond to the interpretation of the dreams that were not favorable to them. He didn't know if he would survive the lion's den. He didn't know. But he did it anyways. Not only did it lead to promotion, influence, and leadership in a foreign kingdom, but his actions inspired a foreign pagan king to declare, as Daniel came out of the lion's den, saved without a scratch on him, that surely Daniel's God is the only God. And he sent word around the entire world that he had rule and reign over, and he said, Daniel's, this is the only God. Forget the others, forget what you've heard, forget the practices we've done. Daniel's God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's the only God. It's it. So that is insane. The way Daniel lived his life and served faithfully caused a king to declare in a pagan culture that there is one God, and it is Daniel's God. You never know what your act of faithfulness. You never know who might be watching. You never know what impact it might have. You never know what your quiet influence, just daily practicing your faithfulness and integrity in your workplace, in your schools, in your sports teams, in your family. You never know. You never know what might happen. Maybe it'll take 60 to 70 years. Maybe you're going to go through some bumps in the road and have to cross some hurdles, but you never know what might happen. God might use your stand for him in an amazing way. So when we leave this morning, the comfort of this awesome Christian community, and we go back into the world that might be far from Jesus, know that the God who is with Daniel in the king's palace in the midst of exile, the God who is with Daniel in the midst of a lion's den, the God who is with Daniel as he influenced kings, is the same God that is with you. He's in your workplace. He's in your home. He's in your relationships. That God is with you. Let's pray. God, we thank you so much. We thank you for our nation, because despite the craziness, we have it so much better than so many people around the world. And so we are truly grateful for Canada. God, we are grateful for this church and this community where we get to come and we get to share and we get to worship together and we get to learn together and we get to be in community together. And God, I pray for everyone who's leaving this room and going into a place where maybe they feel like they're the only one trying to live out this faith journey well, that they would be emboldened by your spirit to not be someone who just throws stones and stands on the sideline, but who makes a choice to live with excellence and show people that there's a better way. There is a way of hope and a way of life, and it is found in Jesus. So God, by your spirit, would you empower us? Would you give us confidence to communicate in relatable and kind and generous ways? To be like Daniel and add value to the culture that we live in? God, we are so grateful for your word and the stories like this that we get to learn from and be inspired by this word that is alive and is transforming us. And God, we thank you for your spirit, that even though you ask really difficult and challenging things of us, you don't leave us on our own to do it. You have sent your spirit to live inside of us so that when our strength ends, your spirit takes over and carries us the rest of the way. So God, we are desperate for you and for you to invade the situations and the places in our life that feel broken and hopeless in ways that only you can. So God, we love you and we worship you. And everybody said, amen. Amen.